Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Mon.
And welcome back to Masters of Mon. I am your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Modern Masters Anticipation Build-Up Weeks. This is an exciting-looking set.
It's really just unfair of Wizards. They should warn us how sweet the set was going to be so that I could save more money than I've saved so I can buy more of it. It's just really not okay.
Yeah, it looks really exciting. It's made me laugh. Our friend posted on our friend who does not play a lot of Modern posted on a Facebook group, and he said, MM2 or MM3, Trilands, Guildgates, Fetchlands, Signets. I like fixing just like the next guy, but it seems that it'd be taking up a ton of slots in the set. Would rather have money cards opened. What I want to say is, like, did you look at the spoiler?
Yeah, I was like, so many sad violins for how awful your life was. You opened Might of Olcroz's Paths. And
yeah, so sad for all the commons and uncommons that you're going to open that are, like, reasonable cards to own. Like, did you see the spoilers? We got literally everything. Like,
right.
There's not a card. I mean, we're not going to do a full spoiler episode, I don't think, because... Or a full set review episode, probably, because...
Yeah, we will. We'll do one next week.
Like a full one?
Yeah. Our next week's episode will be about Modern Masters.
Okay, great. Because it feels like they've spoiled most of the relevant cards, and like everything we wanted is there.
Yeah. I think we could talk about how wrong we were, because we were really wrong.
Well, they just designed it differently, but we'll get to that in another episode. Yeah. So, anyway, that is the thing that's happening right now. There's some cool Modern stuff coming up on the horizon.
Well, due to a little bit of Modern news, SCG Modern Open Indianapolis was last week, ad nauseum won, and that's sick.
Yep.
It makes sense in this format, because so much of it is now pretty creature, anti-creature, just because Death Shadow Zoo is... everywhere, so able to handle that makes it so you have to play pretty good creature removal.
But just like we said, in case you missed the episode with Corey from 2 weeks ago, it's not really Death Shadow Zoo. It's like Death Shadow Jund, sort of.
Death Shadow's aggro is now what I guess what it's called. Yeah. Not Zoo anymore.
Since Gitaxian Probe is banned, it's a different deck, but it is still a Death Shadow deck.
Death Shadow's deck requires you to have a multitude of removal. That makes your deck pretty bad against Ad Nauseam, and now we live in the world we live in. Abzan got second. It seems like with Fatal Push, it's been able to take over from Jund, because now the red isn't as strong as it used to be. They have kind of the tools they need to fight with Abzan. Bitten Eldrazi in third, my favorite four-color deck.
My favorite thing, by the way, just another another Modern Masters point, is that like it's legitimately a set that they get to design for the sake of reprints. Because the card Death Shadow is such a weird card, and that was spoiled as one of the reprint rares. It's not even a mythic. That's like such a strange card to throw into a set as a reprint, but it's just thrown in because you need it as a Modern staple. And that's great. That's so great that we have that now, that we actually have a set that can just give us those cards, even though it has basically no relevance to any draft archetype. So anyway.
There were 7 copies of it in the top 30, though.
Yeah, I mean it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's pretty well represented, and this is SCG, so it's a little bit different. Fatal Push was the most played card in the format. After that, Tarmogoyf. After that, Inquisition of Kozilek, our fave.
The card that we spoiled for the first time.
Ever seen it before. We spoiled it this week. Death Shadow, Full Manor Mage, Street Wraith, Mishra's Bauble, which seems to be the biggest miss for Masters of Modern or Modern Masters 3. Traverse the Ulamvald and Surgical Extraction. Most of those are cards out of Death Shadow, though.
Bauble.
In fact, every single one of those cards is in Death Shadow.
Has every single card been spoiled yet? No, they haven't revealed the full spoiler.
No, it's Thursday. We'll see it all tomorrow morning.
So it's possible Mishra's Bauble's still around.
Yeah. There's definitely a big reveal. There's like a couple more good cards we're gonna get tomorrow when they put the whole set online.
Sweet.
They wanted it to be Damnation originally.
The big one.
So you're like, oh man, they didn't reprint Damnation again, and
they're gonna give it
boom,
to us.
Damnation,
but blow our minds. Yep.
So that's kind of the most of the news. There also we have a few announcements to make regarding GP San Antonio.
Yeah, definitely. So GP San Antonio is coming up, and it's at the end of the month. It's Team Unified Modern, which is an awesome, awesome format that is rarely represented. In fact, is this the first time this has ever been a Grand Prix format? I think they've done it once before, right?
Modern?
Team Unified Modern?
Nah, I think they've done it once, and I can't even promise that's true.
Yeah, I feel like I have a memory of it. But in any case, it's exciting. It's extremely exciting for us as guys that talk about deck building all the time and utilizing cards outside of just like the best 10 cards in Modern. So the plan is, Kessler can't go, but I'm going to be going. okay. to the GP. And I'm going to be playing. And I currently don't have teammates. Now, there are people we can reach out to, but I think it would be more fun for me to form a team with two of our listeners. And this is an idea that I have that we've talked about a little bit, and we're unsure exactly of how that would go or anything like that, but we pretty much have, you pretty much have, every modern card necessary just about to make the decks, which means realistically, we could promise the decks to our teammates. I could bring the cards and bring any two people
right,
that wanted to come.
Decks, yeah.
So I think the idea would be anybody, this is going to be a random drawing for people that are going. So anybody who is going that donates to our Patreon currently is automatically signed up for this drawing. Who it would be?
And they would get basically like 10 entries per if you're a Patreon donation.
Yes.
And then
the other way to get an entry as a possible teammate of the Masters of Modern team would be to go to our iTunes page and leave us a rating and a review. And that's all you have to do is you have to follow us on Twitter, give us a rating and review on iTunes, or be a Patreon subscriber. So with the two things or the one thing. And that's how you get entered. And you will have a higher likelihood of getting picked if you're a Patreon subscriber. So if you want to do that too, that's the easiest way to just get in. A minimum of, we'll say, a $5 donation, which is the deck tech level.
I would say even like I would say any level on the Patreon.
Any level?
Yeah, you get submitted. Yeah.
Sure. Sounds good. Yeah. Sounds good to me. So that's the plan. So when you listen to this episode...
You have to already be going. So please realize we can't fly someone there. We can't, you know, we don't have the ability to accomplish that. But if you are going to be at San Antonio, you want to be on Ben's team.
Yeah.
You will get official Masters of Modern swag, though, as part of the team. You'll get play mats. You'll get other cool fun stuff.
Exactly. And it'll be super fun. We'll get to chat in the weeks leading up to the event, come up with our plan together, decide on the decks we want to play together. So that is something I'm really excited about. And our Patreon currently does okay for us. It mostly makes us enough money to pay Mike to edit our videios and occasionally replan our, you know, mics or cables and things like that. And so,
do fun stuff.
Yeah, exactly. If you guys, anybody who wants to donate to the Patreon as is, even if you're not going, it would be awesome.
Yes,
Patreon.com/TheMMCast. But if you do want to go and be a part of this, go do that. That would be really cool. It would help us put this together and have a place to stay when we're there and have a great time. So that's the plan. That's the current contest. It's not even really a contest. It's just an offer. It would be really fun. I want to play with you guys.
Well, there's like a raffle.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So there might be some like second place prizes we'll throw out there.
So go and find us on Twitter at TheMMCast. Go and find Kessler.
At Kess Wiley.
And go and find me at Ben Bateman Media. And lastly, if you're listening to this right now on Friday, I'm in Vegas right now for a convention called KlexaCon. It has to do with some characters on television from last year. It's a convention highlighting positive LGBTQ rep on television. And I'm there doing press for that. So I would love to play some Vegas Magic if people are around and want to play it all, like an FNM maybe or anything. I don't really know what time I'm going to have available, but hopefully some, and it would be cool to meet you guys. So hit me up at Ben Bateman Media and tweet at me, and maybe we'll get in touch.
Yeah.
That is pretty much that as far as that goes. Other news?
Well, we spoiled two cards earlier this week. That's the only thing I can think of. You can also make sure to check out collected.company. That's where we are. That's where we live. That's also where our sister podcast, The Command Zone, lives, and they released it another Game Nights video, which is them. They do like a cool reality TV show about them all playing Commander against each other. That's really sweet. And yeah, that's kind of the big ones.
Yeah, I think that pretty much is the gist of it.
All right, so let's get into the main subject of the episode.
We have a special guest on today's episode, and that is Patrick Chapin. We're going to be having a discussion with Patrick about new card types being printed in Magic, evaluating the power levels of those card types, and how to properly evaluate them in terms of deck building and trying to take advantage of them. So that is coming up in just a second.
Hey, Patrick. How's it going? Welcome on to the cast.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Doing great, man. Doing great. This is an episode we've had in mind for quite a while, and there's really no better person to talk to than the ultimate Magic historian in Patrick Chapin. So thanks for coming on and talking to us about this.
Flattery will get you everywhere. You know, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. So the idea for this segment is that with Smuggler's Copter getting banned in Standard and then seeing such a high density of Heart of Kirin show up at the Pro Tour, we started thinking about the fact that in the early stages of any new card type, design doesn't seem to have the greatest grasp on power level yet. And you've seen this in the early days of Planeswalkers, the early days of equipment. So we want to talk about sort of all of those things. And I figured the best way to do it would be step by step. So the first thought would be, would you agree that Planeswalkers, equipment, and now vehicles are the most relevant sort of new card types printed in the, like, say, let's just say modern competitive era of Magic?
You're saying equipment, vehicles, and Planeswalkers?
Yeah, was there a really important new one that I'm missing that we like have had to...
I mean, there's Tribal. I don't know if you consider that important.
No, they never really pushed the Tribal type past that set.
Well, it was also kind of the reverse with Tribal. The problem with Tribal is more... Tribal is only relevant if it's always going to be relevant, and they kind of didn't make it always relevant and then decided to just kind of leave it in the dust.
And I suppose that with vehicles, we'll see what happens, but they're pretty awesome so far, so I wouldn't surprise me if vehicles come back later on in a big way.
So I guess my first question for Patrick is, how do you feel about vehicles?
How do I feel about them?
Yeah. From a power level perspective, how are they good for Magic? How they've affected Standard? Where they kind of like place for you?
Let's see. So from a power level perspective, there's a range of power levels that I think that they are a little, I would guess that on the average, they are a little stronger than perhaps internally they realized. I think that they wanted to be sure to make sure that the vehicles were good enough. And they erred on the side of pushing some hard enough to be sure that they showed up. In terms of the quality of design or if they're good for Magic, I think that, first of all, there's a very different bar for what you want to be omnipresent versus what makes for a fun six-month vacation or a two-year vacation. And I think that... In the full range of experiences for Magic vehicles, it's a very ambitious thing they tried to do, and I think that they pulled it off very well. I think that the play experience of vehicles is good. I think that they are, in many ways, it's weird, right? Because they're kind of equipment, and they're kind of creatures, but they also are... a little bit of what, you know, they're half and half of kind of equipment and creatures, and have a little bit different of a play experience than either one. I wouldn't want vehicles to be super prevalent all the time the way that they are in this block. But I think that, like, for instance, when Mirrodin unveiled equipment, there's just a huge, huge, huge amount of it. And I think that they've gotten into a good balance with there being different amounts of equipment from set to set, sometimes not at all, sometimes a bunch, sometimes only a very little, but not just tons and tons of it. I would guess that the correct amount of vehicles is probably less than the amount of equipment by a fair bit, but I think that they could revisit it some.
How parasitic do you feel like the design of vehicles are? Like, obviously you have... cards that reference an effect when you crew something, but it's, you know, beyond those cards that really do make the vehicles better, just standing on their own, saying mixing with other cards in Modern and whatnot, do you feel like you sort of need to play with the cards vehicles were designed to play with, or that they're strong enough to exist as we go forward in Magic with just generic cards?
I guess if you're saying, like, are there any vehicles strong enough to play with going forward? The answer would be absolutely yes. They don't really rely on the synergies as much as they are raw rate. Like, they're just like equipment. Some of the equipment you're only going to play if you have incentives, but some of the equipment is just so good you'll just play with it anyway. And I think that, like, things like Smuggler's Copter and Heart of Kirin are so good that you can just play with them because of how efficient they are.
So definitely, and I think I want to end our conversation about the future of vehicles in Modern and talking about the banning of Copter and everything like that. So let's jump back to...
Or at least save it for later in the episode.
Yeah, exactly, because I think that's the most interesting sort of thing for Modern, because Planeswalkers and vehicles exist as possibilities and have existed as possibilities in Modern, but... When Mirrodin was originally announced, and you said they printed so many pieces of equipment, That was like a really big deal. Equipment, just as a new card type, it was unfamiliar how it worked. The fact that you could only equip at sorcery speed sort of took a minute to wrap your mind around because it looked like an activated ability on a card. And yet you obviously had cards like, you had cards like Skullclamp, and you had the original cycle of swords that were very, very, very powerful compared to some commons and even uncommons that were just not even close to the same power level, followed by obviously Jitte in the next block. How do you think that changed Magic? How would you compare that to vehicles?
How did the printing of equipment change Magic?
Yeah, just in terms of like them wrapping their head around designing something so new and innovative, and like obviously the scope there in terms of Skullclamp all the way up to Shuko, I feel like they didn't quite have their head wrapped around how to design it in the beginning, and that was evident in the swinginess of cards like Skullclamp. How would you compare those two things? Like, do you think vehicles came out the gate much, much, much more balanced than equipment did?
I would say that, see, it's kind of just, it's tricky figuring out the right way to answer the question accurately, because from my perspective, equipment are just licids.
Right. Okay. That's fair.
Yeah. And the licids themselves, I mean, if you keep going back, they're just, for instance, there was like there were a number of artifacts in the first year that Magic was made that had activated abilities where you tap the artifact, paid some mana, and gave a bonus to your creature. You know, like you could tap and pay 3 mana to give your creature +2/+0 until end of turn.
Right.
And the idea of having permanents that can buff your other creatures for a little while, and they can only buff one creature at a time. And when you, because I mean, if you go all the way back, there was Bad Moon in the beginning, right, in Crusade and things like that, Orcish Oriflamme. But as if very early in Magic, they started experimenting with other permanents that could sit in play that you could choose to use to power up your creature, but you could only power up one creature at a time with them. You know, and they're all just variations of that same type of experience. And I from my perspective, equipment are just the, I don't know, 17th version of that mechanic that they made. It's a subtype. It's not even like really a new card type, but it is a new set of puzzles, because the way they ask you to balance your resources changed a little bit. You know, like it is still just an artifact that you pay a cost, and that guy is powered up. You know, that creature is powered up for some period of time until you pay the cost again to move it to something else, and it has the attribute of not going away if the creature dies. You know, so it just has, I don't know. It to me, they're similar, and that the real reason that equipment weren't balanced better when they first came out is the same reason that Arcbound Ravager wasn't balanced when it first came out. There was just that was during a period of time in which there were not the final design resources and the technology for how to balance sets that were necessary for the types of designs they were trying to explore. You know, I think this has happened at a few different other points in Magic's history as well. And right now we see Planeswalkers. I mean, sorry, we see vehicles not exactly being in the exact, you know, in the perfect spot. They're in a pretty they did a pretty decent job, but I think that right now we're seeing a little bit of a downswing with regards to power level balance, and that we're going to see a big improvement a couple years from now. There's just a long lag because of how long ago they had to design all these cards.
Right.
I actually would argue that Planeswalkers are a great example of the success out the gate. If you look at the first Planeswalkers, Jace Beleriand, Garrick Wildspeaker, Chandra Nalar, Liliana Vess, and Johnny Goldmane, that's a pretty reasonable mix of Planeswalkers, you know?
Yeah, I think there's an agreement in the community that the initial five were just fantastic. I mean, that was
well balanced. They each had, other than Chandra, they each had moments where they were heavily played in tournament play. They're also mostly, almost all of them, other than Chandra again, are casual favorites in different ways. They like kind of hit every spot on the mark that they needed to.
And I think it's interesting.
Oh, see, I played Chandra a fair bit, actually.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Maybe that's weird.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. No, I think it's interesting if you look at those cards, too. You know, we did the bracket kind of recently, I don't know, a few months ago of the top. We ranked every Planeswalker. And it seemed like when we were getting into the top 20, I think Garrick Wildspeaker would made it the top 10 for us. I think Jace Beleriand was top 20 for us.
Well, and I also think like Planeswalker, I think every new permanent type vehicles and Planeswalkers, they did really well in the beginning. I think that one of the reasons is that there was only five. They had five. They like tested those really well. With equipment and vehicles, it's more of a shotgun blast of here's 30 different designs we can come out with because this is our new exciting thing and we want it to be more of a common thing than necessarily Planeswalkers were. But if you like extrapolate Planeswalkers for the next 3 years, like you get a much more swingy quality control kind of level where you get stuff like Elsbeth, Liliana the Veil, Jace the Mind Sculptor alongside Sarkhan Vol, six mana Chandra, four mana Nissa, who was really good at time warp because the elves deck than she herself was. But you get when you have so many knobs, which you have with equipment and you have with vehicles, it takes time to master exactly the best way to kind of keep them fair and from dominating a format.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, please.
What I was going to ask was, so, you know, on Top Level Podcast with you and Flores, you guys will do, when you have spoilers and new sets, you'll sort of do the walkthrough discussion of, well, you know, for this card, you get this rate, it could work like this. And I've heard it's a very, very analytical, very like processed way of talking about these things. So going back just for a second to the sort of unbalanced nature of those really, really swingy equipment, do you remember looking at, say, Skullclamp and saying, like, that is totally unfair. I'm going to play that as a 4-of, no question if I'm allowed to. Or was it sort of like looking at Copter where everybody's like, yeah, that's probably one of the best new cards. We don't really know how it's going to work, but we'll try it out. But I'll bet you that's pretty good. I mean, was there a difference there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little surreal. So I'm coming from a little bit of a funny position on Skullclamp. I was at Wizards of the Coast when Skullclamp was initially designed.
Oh.
And suggested the whole drawing two cards.
As opposed to one?
But at the time, it cost two to a cast and three to equip.
Oh.
And gave the creature +1/+2.
Oh, man.
And then I had to leave. And during the later part of Mirrodin. And I still remember them. We were still doing some stuff by mail, and I remember them sending me a message about the update to Skullclamp, and it was like, uh-oh.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, it's like, uh-oh, in terms of – that's kind of the whole point of this discussion is you talk about those Planeswalkers and how well-designed they are, how sort of three-mana like Jace Beleriand, like that's such an interesting yet simple Magic card.
I also think like Skullclamp's a bad example of like bad knobs because it's like it's a very uniquely it's not really an equipment. It does something else. Like
yeah,
I
right,
mean, like
right,
more
right.
Like Jitte or the protection swords are more, I think, comparable to
I mean Jitte's another one.
And Chopter.
Yeah, Jitte is another one. When you look at Jitte, I think it's a little harder to evaluate Jitte as totally unfair right out the gates. But
and then
like
you play with it at a pre release and you're like, oh.
Yeah, but that card's nuts, right?
Yeah. I think that Umezawa's Jitte. If the question is Umezawa's Jitte nuts? The answer is yes. There are very few cards in the modern era as nuts of design as Umezawa's Jitte. The convergence of being not even in the right zip code, not even the right zip code of power level, combined with an atrocious play pattern. yeah, that is a nuts design, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, but what's interesting about Jitte is like it has that same thing that Copter has where it's effective attacking or blocking, right?
Well, yeah, but it's about the rate because a lot of really, really good cards don't attack and block. And there are a lot of cards that attack and block that aren't very good. The fact that this one does both is secondary to the numbers written on the card and the the variety of options that the card gives you. and the relative utility in the context that the card is legal. The like Smuggler's Copter, I think Umezawa Shite its existence is the convergence of three different risks that can all go bad sometimes with magic designs. The first is that when you make late changes, there can be consequences that you don't always see. Umezawa Shite was never playtested a single game.
You know this from, you know, the story that
I know this. I know for sure. It literally got changed last minute, and it was a speculative because the thing is that Umezawa Shite originally didn't have the minus one ability.
Right.
It had get a mana. Like it was like a lotus petal of sorts. It was like get a mana instead, but that didn't work within the rules. Like there were some complex reasons why they didn't want to have a mana ability. You couldn't, basically they would have had to list it as two different abilities because you couldn't mix a mana ability and a non-mana ability on a modal activated ability at the time. And so they last minute, they're like, okay, well, if you can't have a lotus petal, why don't we just change it to something safe? Like -1/-1.
Yes. Yeah, right. Exactly. Well,
I mean, and there's like a history, like Batterskull is the same deal where they're at the last minute, they changed it from, I believe it was like 5 or 8 mana to make a germ token that it's attached to instead of returning it to your hand. And then even up till the new Guardian or Felt Sovereign, the new cat.
Yeah,
the
right.
Silly combo, where it originally was artifacts and creatures. And they're like, let's just make it permanence to make Revolt better and to make it kind of function a little bit more cleaner. And then they like missed the fact that it comboed with Saheeli.
Yeah, and we always talk about this. Like, well, it seems like there's got to just be, you know, a monkey at a typewriter being paid to essentially just like go through every card ever and be like, well, how does it play with this? And how does it play with this? And is that a problem? And it's like, the reality is, no matter how many people you hired, no matter how specific the process would be, you'd still always miss something. It would be impossible to not.
Well, yeah, you're always going to miss stuff at some point, but there are a variety of things that you could have as part of your process that would cut off a great number of these, you know, from learning from some of the mistakes in the past. For instance, the list is actually not that long of game of combo engines in Magic. And if whenever there is an engine that has one type of input and one type of output, there are potentials for loops. And you could actually just compare all of the cards that only have one input and give an output to see if there's anything that produces the outputs, the thing that they need as an input. You know, like, for instance, Felidar Guardian, its input is entering the battlefield, and its output is blinking something.
Right.
But the thing about – but the blinking things is like copying things where it breaks lots of other things that only have one type of input.
Well, right. I was going to say the number of cards – and you knew this because you guys talked about it on your show, but the number of cards that do an instantaneous blink – as opposed to an end of turn blink and reference permanent is extremely small. Like there's almost none that have ever been printed. So like, that's one of those things when you look at that, what?
Less than 10.
Oh, I think significantly less than 10. You have things that blink creatures. You have things that blink like, what is Cloud Shift blink a permanent or is cloud? Yeah. There's like a couple, but again, that's a spell. So it's like,
you mean creatures that blink creatures.
Yeah. I mean, there's almost, it's just almost a thing that doesn't exist. So like you're saying, Patrick, about the, you know, the input and the output, when you think about that, okay, where does this fit and what does it fall in line with? You're absolutely right. You know, the testing should be a little more refined there because they should be able to immediately say, okay, yeah, this combos with another card that's going to be in standard and it's totally unique. And that other card is totally unique. But I mean, that's the whole printing things you haven't printed before. That's exactly what we're talking about.
I think that with Skull Clamp, Umezawa's GTA, Smuggler's Copter, if you'll notice, a lot of these things, it's not necessarily that they are new card types so much as they're artifacts. And that brings me to the second of the, well, that brings me to the second of the three big risks here. There's a long-term long time systemic failing on the development side for artifacts when they are explicitly pushing artifact theme blocks or sets or mechanic or whatever it is, because normally artifacts exist in this space in which there is an opportunity cost that you are getting color pie bleeds and versatile utility, but at the expense of efficiency. And every single time they do any sort of remotely artifact block, whether it's Mirrodin, Scars of Mirrodin, Aether Revolt, and Kaladesh, there's a similar problem that keeps happening where they're like, well, this is an artifact set. I must be sure that the artifacts are really good. And when you make the artifact so pushy that it's at a more efficient rate than the colored card, the problem actually spirals out of control because it no longer has the fundamental limiting factor of each color having strengths and weaknesses the way that the game is balanced around. And that's why I think actually the development problems you're describing are actually primarily systemic failings on the development side to balance artifact mechanics. And every time they make a new artifact mechanic and they want to show it off, whether it's affinity or equipment or vehicles or whatever it is, metalcraft, doesn't matter. Every time there are always some amount of problems that go along with when they say, oh, we must make sure that we push some artifact or artifact enabling theme enough to be in high tier one.
Well, yeah, I mean, and even if you look at Magic Origins with, you know, Hangerback Walker and now Walking Ballista, when they a push artifact has the potential, because it can be played in any deck, to kind of break down what Magic is supposed to be about. I mean, and up to the extent that I generally argue that green is the second most powerful color in Magic, but one of the reasons it's been looked down so ill-fondly over the years is because the thing that it's best at is, you know, ramping mana. And for the first 10 years of Magic's history, artifacts were what was doing that at a higher rate. You had the Moxes, you had Black Lotus, you had Signets, you had whatever you had.
Talismans.
You had things taking away from green's main strength, and then once they kind of pulled that away, green was able to kind of be like, oh no, we're the ramp color, this is what we're supposed to be good at. Land of War Elves is obviously really good, and same as Birds of Paradise. And so now, when you get into artifact sets, taking away other colors' strengths is what makes those colors weak. Even if you look at Battle for Zendikar block, green was the worst draft color in BFC draft because all of the Eldrazi did it better than them. They had bigger creatures and they ramped better than green was doing.
And to that point, Patrick, what you were just saying, and I'll just say this really quickly and you can jump in, is that it's not even just artifacts. It's pushing colorless, because we saw what happened when they
100%
pushed,
agree.
When they pushed colorless, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, the downside of playing, you know, pain lands in your Eldrazi deck, it was like, okay, well, now in Modern, we're going to build the most broken Modern deck that's like ever been built, because you can just smash colorless cards and it's so easy.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that if you look at all the different times, because it's not really about artifacts, it's about colorless, whether it's Strip Mine with Mishra's Factory, if it's Dismember, Mutagenic Growth, and Gutshot, if it's a Mental Misstep, any of that stuff, right? Gitaxian Probe, if it's any amount of the colorless, the Eldrazi, it's always when they push the things that break the existence of a color pie, the things just start to break down. And as far as the Battle for Zendikar, I would actually, I don't know, maybe it's like only tangential to the point, but I'm actually not convinced that it is the Eldrazi's fault that green was the weakest in Battle for Zendikar. I actually think that perhaps the greatest fault was the fact that at Wizards of the Coast, during the development of that set, the best drafter on their final design team loved drafting green. And as result, he was skewing the results internally, and they balanced around him existing. And they ended up doing things like, for instance, you know that card that makes 2/1/1 Scions? It costs 3 instead of 2. And so, like, I think that you could have just changed a couple of the numbers and easily green would have been the best, regardless, even if you didn't power up its acceleration, even if the Eldrazi were better at that jam, you could just make the numbers bigger. Like, for instance, in Modern, Tarmogoyf, Grim Flayer, Knight of the Reliquary, Scavenging Ooze, Primeval Titan, I think there's a really good case to be made for green having the best fatties, you know, if you set aside like weird combo creatures.
I'd currently argue that green is the best color in modern, but yeah, I agree.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I think you can make a pretty good argument about that. I also think that it's a little strange, the idea of holding on to green as though it's not a strong color, because at this point, green has been one of the strongest colors for so long, right, over the life. I mean, Magic's 24 years old?
Yeah.
There's been a really good portion of that period of time where green has been quite good. And even if it was somewhat maligned before, some of the green cards have aged pretty well from the old days, you know?
Well, yeah, we always talk about how funny it is when you go back to look at the way the cards were designed in the first 5 years. And some things are so out of whack, but you go look at, like, you know, Cockatrice was a rare, right? Or like, you look at some of the green cards and the way that green was utilized, you know, a card like Crawworm, which I guess is a common anyway, but if you look at like what gets printed now.
Cockatrice actually, I think, is a really smart rare. Because what Garfield was trying to do at the time, he was trying to suggest that green, it's not common for green to get flying. And in fact, that's part of the reason why he made Script Sprite. And Script Sprite being a 1/1, and then Birds of Paradise being a 0/1. Like, but he wanted to show this is not usual. Green's flyers, when you look at like Birds of Paradise, Cockatrice, they're all rare except for Script Sprite, which was intentionally weak.
Right.
You know,
right.
Small. Not. It wasn't actually that inefficient compared to some of the other creatures. But
yeah, Cockatrice, legal in modern, by the way. But no, so
for those who don't know, green 3 flying 2/4 that for all intents and purposes has death touch.
Yeah.
Non-walls.
It's not a modern playable card, but it has some elements that would make it at least somewhat interesting in modern because it has 4 toughness. But in any case, and it costs 5, so it survives Fatal Push, both Fatal Push and Lightning Bolt.
That's true.
That card's tech.
It's kind of like a Vampire Nighthawk.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a Vampire Nighthawk, but it costs 2 more. And instead of having lifelink, it doesn't kill walls. It has an extra point of tough, you know.
Yeah. It's lightning bolt proof and it can't kill walls.
So let's just go through the ages really quickly. If you look at the pieces of equipment that were printed in Ravnica block, the third time that they could print equipment, it's like Rakdos Right Knife. And like, I wish I had the list directly in front of me here, but it's, you know, there's like 6 pieces of equipment or something like that. And it's pretty clear that, you know, they shot equipment out of a cannon in the first block. They designed one really flashy piece of equipment for the block following. Like, okay, we want this to be a thing and it's a legendary, so we're going to do one really good one. And it's totally unbalanced. By the time they did it the third time, it was like...
What are you speaking of?
I'm saying Jitte. Jitte was like the one really flashy piece of equipment in Kamigawa block. Am I forgetting another incredible piece of equipment in that block?
I mean, I don't know. I thought that Tetsumesa, the Dragon's Fang or whatever, was like a more compelling, like more flashy. Umezawa's Jitte was just like costed wrong. Godo Bandit Warlord, you know, when Godo Bandit Warlord goes and gets the Dragon Fang or whatever it is, let me see. What all? Because I thought there were like a few different pieces of equipment in Kamigawa block. Yeah, are you saying just in terms of like the power level?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm trying to sort of get at. Is like thinking about the way we remember these and the way they were evaluated out the gates. It's like they didn't give us like a bunch of cards with a really competitive rate that will go down as legendary in the next set, right? Like the first, you can at least say that the first block of Mirrodin block has the 2 swords and Skullclamp. Like, just alone, those 3 cards are, like, iconic and incredible and played to this day.
Plating.
Plating, yeah. So you have, like, you have 4, really, that are, like, unbelievable
cards. Bone Splitter's.
Yeah, Bone Splitter's good, but, I mean, it's really good.
It's unprintable in any draft format, but yeah.
Yeah, so, but I guess...
It's sick, but yeah.
So the point I tried to make here is, by the third time they did it, it seems like they had figured it out. So I wanted to sort of move that thought to Planeswalkers next and think about a little bit. Okay, we all agree the first 5 were great. Now the next set of them
5
was just at what?
5 Tezzeret, Elsbeth,
yep.
Sarkhan Vol, Nicol Bolas, a Johnny Vengeant. Two of those are on the list of best Planeswalkers ever, and one of them is on a list of people's favorite Planeswalker, and if it costs less than 8 and Cool and a Manum was just a better card in the exact same cost, would be considered one of the best Planeswalkers whatever, ever.
Are any of the original 5 as good as Elspeth, a Johnny Vengeant, or Tezzeret?
Yeah, Garrick, Jace.
What do you think, Patrick?
Are any of the original 5 as powerful
as
or
these,
as good of designs?
As powerful? How would you rank those 8?
As powerful as... which 8? Aren't there? You're speaking of 10, though, right?
So let's rank the 10. I was sort of throwing out the Sarkhan Vol because he's kind of
sorry, Chavin. Sorry, between the two, which one would you say is the best designed ones set, and which one is the more powerful set?
For full sets,
yeah, 5 and 5.
I think. I think Ajani, Vengeant, Elspeth. And Jace Beleriand are in another league compared to, it also depends on what kind of a context you're talking.
Sure.
But Elspeth, I think is the strongest of those. I think Elspeth is the strongest of those 10, and Ajani Vengeant is the other. I don't know. Ajani Vengeant and Elspeth are both they're two very high on the list. And I think Jace Beleriand would be in my top 10 most powerful list. Historically, I think that beyond that, I guess Garruk would be number 4. Is that right? And then
it'd be Garruk or Tezzeret. Tezzeret's the only one, and that's format dependent. And
the 5 cost Tezzeret.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't know. I think the 5 cost Tezzeret's not particularly pushy. Like I think the 5 cost Tezzeret is like. That it gets played in vintage at times is really just a function of the design of the card. It was designed to be used with Time Vault so that there would be a Planeswalker in vintage.
Sure,
It's not like the card on its own was strong. I guess it's stronger than Liliana Vess,
right.
And it's stronger than Ajani Goldmane, but I don't think it's... I think it might even be weaker than Nicol Bolas, just in terms of rate. I don't know.
Okay, interesting. Because I guess the third part of that conversation, which is doesn't really need to be documented very closely, because it's been talked about to death, is that the third set, of course, introduced Jace the Mind Sculptor, like the strongest Planeswalker ever printed, and one of the 5 best Magic cards ever printed, probably. So they seem to...
Five. There's like a... Power 9 ahead of it, and Power 8, and Time Vault.
You're right. If you really want to put...
Modern Magic test.
But yeah, in terms of cards that have been printed in like the modern and even overextended era of Magic, I would say that Jace the Mind Sculptor is like... I mean, how high would you put it, Patrick?
Well, I can tell you the last time I did a list... Like, I had to do a list just a couple years ago of the 100 most powerful Magic cards ever made based on rate.
Yeah.
And, efficiency. And Jace the Mind Sculptor was in my top 25 all time.
Yeah.
And my top 25 includes Black Lotus, 5 Moxes, Soul Ring, Mana Crypt, Ancestral Recall, Time Walk, Demonic Tutor. It's a really tough list to get into.
All cards printed in 1993 and then a card printed
no,
in
like... No, I think that Tinker and Yawgmoth's Will... And I think Tinker and Yawgmoth's Will should be on the list.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you.
Yeah. But it's confusing what your metric is, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, and then past the third time they had done it, I mean, you did have in that third set of 6 in the third block there, you know, Gideon Jura is a really nicely designed Planeswalker. He's a super solid Planeswalker with a great rate. Jace is way over the top. And the rest in that block.
I think Gideon is way over the top.
You think he's crazy powerful?
Yeah, I agree.
I think Gideon Jura, I mean, you can do that kind of thing sometime. It's not like there's a right cost for every card. There's different curves of rate and of power, of like mana efficiency, depending on what the purpose of the thing is. And I think that sometimes you can make. There are cards that need that have a purpose that requires them to be stronger than other cards. I think that Gideon Jura is stronger than I would normally want to make a card like that, but But I think that in context, it makes a lot of sense. Because you can also design to the world where you just are making things like Bloodbraid Elf and Vengevine and Jace the Mind Sculptor and Raging Ravine. I mean, you can design to that world too if you want. There's different curves. It's just that I think that part of the reason they let things get so inflated at that point is that when they were making some of the development decisions during that time period and the couple of years leading up to it, Magic was really struggling. And the reason that they were inflating was that there is you can subsidize design by making your new cards more powerful than the old ones so that people stop playing with the old ones and play with the new ones. So like if you think that your new designs are more fun, you can just keep upping the, now it grows out of control really, really quickly, but if you think that Magic's dying, which at that time period they did, because they were responding to Darksteel, and the couple years after Darksteel, Magic was doing terrible. Magic fell off a cliff. And part of the reason they pulled back so much on the equipment is that every single thing that was introduced during Mirrodin and Darksteel and Fifth Dawn, every single thing going on, they tried to walk back and they tried to tone down by the time they actually could once they saw how devastated the Magic community was in terms of the people playing, the numbers of players. And it takes them about, they're on like a 2-year lag. So that's part of the reason why you see the outrageously powerful equipment in Mirrodin relative to like historical, you know, where it's sort of settled into in general. And then why you see 2 years later, they chill out. It's because they started chilling out the second they saw what was happening from Darksteel.
Right.
And it took them that long. Because Kamigawa, I would argue, has a number of other busted equipment. Like, I think that Shuko is just completely indefensible.
Right. But I mean, in the all times.
It was too late. It was too late for them to do anything. And the latest they could do anything at all was when they printed Kataki, but by then it was too late. With the Planeswalkers, though, what was happening is a little bit the reverse. You see, when they made Jace, Balerion, Garruk, Liliana, and so on, those cards had been designed and developed and were an ongoing process. When I was there in 2002, they were working on what would eventually become Planeswalkers. And that's like, that's many years out. That's like, what is that? That's like, I don't know, 5-6 years earlier. And the next couple years between Lorwyn's release and then all the way up to Zendikar block, during that period of time, they were operating under the assumption that Magic was dying, and they were trying to do whatever they could to prop the game up, to help rebuild the game, to rework the game. And the people who worked on specifically M10, Battle for Zendikar, and Worldwake, they saved Magic to so great a degree because of a combination of New World Order and recapturing the flavor and understanding what was really fun about Magic. And then I think that by the time that Zendikar came out, they actually could see, oh my God, okay, Magic's turning around, things are going really, really well, and so on. But they eventually had to pull back a little bit on the power level because it wasn't sustainable to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And Jace the Mind Sculptor is what happens when sometimes you try to make the best card. Like they tried to make a Babe Ruth.
Right.
They tried just, they aimed for a literal 10 out of 10 of what was possible. And then they turned out to be a little wrong and aimed too high. And that's how you ended up with a card that is so just, it's not even in the zip code of okay.
Right. It's totally, yeah, it's like, I agree with you. It's hilarious. You called Shuko indefensible. That is the most meta statement in the world. It's funny because if you're like the brand new player who's just gotten in Magic and you go and you look in your database, what is Shuko? You're going to compare Shuko to Jace the Mind Sculptor and just like scratch your head. But obviously you're referencing the fact that it has a unique ability that turns on other things and is one of those loop engines you're talking about.
Well, it's not even just those combos. It's the fact that you should not ever print zero cost activated abilities, with no cost, with no, if there's no input, it's already just, it's already indefensible given where Magic was by the time that Shuko got printed. But the Jace the Mind Sculptor, I actually think it's an interesting example, though, of how easy it is in retrospect for people to talk about Jace the Mind Sculptor as being obviously incredible or busted. You got to remember, at the time, people didn't even think Jace the Mind. There were so many people who thought that Jace the Mind Sculptor wasn't good.
I mean, it did. How long did it take? Three weeks in standard before the card totally caught on?
No, I don't know. I mean, the first Pro Tour where it was legal, it did very well. You know, like it top eighted immediately, but it wasn't particularly heavily played, and there was a widespread consensus in the community that it wasn't that strong. And then after the Pro Tour, it started surging, and it grew and grew and grew and grew and started becoming just, you know, played in every single format over the course of a few months. But it took them actually playing with it. It's not like you read the card and know how good it is. It's not as confusing as, like, for instance, Necropotence.
Right, right. It's funny, you talk about the few weeks, you know, the Pro Tour, and then it takes a little while before people get it. And you're talking about something as egregiously powerful as Jace. It's like the same thing as when Tarmogoyf was printed, and it took a few weeks, a month or so, before people really figured out that, like, you know, it's a significantly better card than Wren's Run Vanquisher in the Elf decks. It's just a better card. You should be playing that. It's almost like in the zombie movies when the outbreak starts happening, and you see on the news that, you know, oh, there's crazy stuff happening in another city, and then it's like, well, actually, we're just in the middle of a zombie outbreak. Everyone's dying. Like, this is the thing that's happening right now, you know? It may have seemed like something weird was going on in another part of the world, but the world's caught up.
Yeah, I think that it's like this recurring thing where, despite the fact that Magic's been around for 24 years, people just keep falling for the same joke. They keep looking at cards through the lens of the previous context instead of attempting to understand the rate of the card. The efficiency, the rate of the card is like how much output, how much ability to influence the game are you getting for the cost?
Right.
And if a card has a substantially higher rate than existing cards, there is opportunity even when the card doesn't already have an existing home. And in fact, that's how you know which things to look at beforehand. You can just look at which things are giving you more output. I don't know. I think that people over and over and over again get too hung up on the specific context in a moment, like Jace the Mind Sculptor being printed at a time in which Bloodbraid Elf and Lightning Bolt exist.
Right.
It's like, okay, contextually it has weaknesses against these two cards, but also these are two absurdly powerful cards, and there will not always be exactly these two cards.
Yeah, this is a modern podcast. One of those cards is banned. The other one's the historically the most played card in the history of the format. So, you know, I think we're talking about a pretty strong standard by comparison.
Yes.
So the last point, and what you just said, is everybody keeps falling for the same, you know, the same joke over and over again. That's kind of what inspired this conversation in the first place was, you know, they printed these two, this one piece of equipment in Smuggler's Copter. They followed it up in the next set with Heart of Kieran. And I said from the very beginning, I really felt like Smuggler's Copter was busted. I was like, that card, that feels like modern power level. I know it's a 3-3, but, you know, it's that just feels good to me. Then it gets banned in standard, and all of a sudden I'm looking around, I'm like, all right, guys, I really feel like we're missing something here. There's an opportunity. And like we just saw with the Death Shadow Jund deck, which is almost just becoming like a legacy deck in modern, right? It was there forever. It just took a while for people to sort of figure out, okay, that's actually what we should be doing. I kind of have this feeling that that's going to be the same thing with these vehicles, and I kind of wonder what the future of those cards and then vehicles in general in the next sets they print them, whenever that will be, looks like as it relates to this whole conversation we've just had about equipment and planeswalkers. Like, what do vehicles look like going forward? How good are these cards going to be in modern?
Well, I don't know for sure whether there are going to be any vehicles outside of Kaladesh or Aether Revolt for the time being. I'm not sure. Maybe there will be, maybe there won't. But as speaking only to the vehicles in these two sets, the challenge here is that vehicles require a creature to crew them.
Right.
And the best vehicles, Smuggler's Copter and Heart of Kirin. I mean, to begin with, Smuggler's Copter is already showing up in Modern. It's just, it's not like a dominating card. It's a little bit more fringe. Like it's occasionally used in some affinity decks, as I'm sure you know, but it's not exactly the primary. It's not the main way. It's very fringe and probably not the correct way to even be playing affinity at the moment. But the problem with Smuggler's Copter is that it benefits you for playing with 1/1 creatures, and then it rewards you for things like, not only do you have to already be able to attack with your 1/1 creature, which is a disproportionately large cost in Modern, because in Modern, because of the fact that all the cards are so much more powerful, on the average, everything has bigger stats.
Right.
And so there are less incidental ways to crew a copter without losing more damage. You know, like Thraben Inspector, for instance, is so strong in Standard, but it's just not in the same league as Goblin Guide. And, good.
I was going to say, that's where you, but I mean, that's sort of what I'm talking about. I agree with you. There's a lot of very, very smart people that play Magic and spend all their time designing. And I don't mean to sort of harp on the same cards on this podcast, because I talk about my favorite cards so much, but you know, I see synergies. I see like a synergy between Grand Architect and Smuggler's Copter, where I think, okay, that's a pretty interesting and clever way to use one power on a very powerful creature. I think about, you know, a card like Delver of Secrets, that's a 1/1 that you hope to flip, but sometimes you don't. You know, there's a really good 1/1. I think there's opportunities, and I just have this gut feeling that we're going to see more out of these vehicles in Modern, and I just think it's a door people haven't really opened all the way yet. Like, there's just this, people turn their nose up because they're Standard cards, you know, until they've rotated out of Standard and you sort of have to think like outside the box, how clever am I being? They're just such prominent cards right now. It's almost like people don't like playing with the most prominent cards in Standard in Modern unless they have to.
So I would say that there is definitely a long historical trend of people being confused about Standard cards that are good in Modern. They don't realize that, like, I mean, certain things that are just different new twists on the same old joke that they'll get into, like Snapcaster Mage was easy to figure out because it was like Eternal Witness.
Right.
But Bloodbraid Elf was very confusing at first to people in powered formats. They didn't fully get it. Elspeth Sun's Champion, another great example. I think that definitely there's some amount of people are resistant to vehicles in Modern because it's something new and different and they're not thinking in the right framework yet, and partly because there's so many weird niche interactions that haven't even been discovered yet. I mean, Modern has more interactions than there are atoms in the universe, so it's, and that's not even an exaggeration, it's literally that many interactions that you can't already know how everything's going to interact with everything else. And so somebody getting outside that box and exploring a little bit eventually is going to find more ways to take advantage of a card that has such an incredible rate like Smuggler's Copter. The thing I would note, though, is that you got to be careful with I guess you don't have to. I mean, I guess who really even cares how accurate these type of predictions are? But there is we care when we're making predictions about our own, like when we're holding ourselves accountable, and we want to look for falsifiable claims and not just a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, because like, will Smuggler's Copter ever be good? Yes. And if all you want is to wait until Smuggler's Copter is eventually good and say, see, I knew 4 years ago that eventually Smuggler's Copter would be good. Definitely, it's a very efficient, very powerful card. It doesn't line up particularly well in Modern because of how Fatal Push and Lightning Bolt line up exactly, and the fact that the cost is disproportionately scaling. Like in powered formats, the more something costs in a cost that scales, the worse it ages. And so like you see expensive cards not age as well in Modern as cheap cards because mana is worth more in Modern than it is in Standard. But Smuggler's Copter has the benefit of being cheap, has the benefit of graveyard synergies, has the benefit and also risk of being an artifact in a format that has tons of benefits for artifacts and tons of ways to punish artifacts. There's lots of different factors, but I think you are right. I think Smuggler's Copter will, it will rise. In particular, I think that some ways to take advantage of it in that grand architect space where you're using, you know, you're making it more than the sum of the parts.
Right.
I think that's going to be part of the equation at some point. And then I also just think that there's going to be spots where you incidentally have enough one toughness creatures and also want to be looting that you're going to end up using Smuggler's Copter. I also just think that it's possible as time goes on that, so, you know, like maybe Mox Opal gets banned.
Right.
And Affinity ends up taking a slightly slower approach, and then you end up with, you know, really valuing the fact that Smuggler's Copter is synergizing with Ornithopter and Signal Pest and Ink Moth Nexus and being part of this whole flying theme, you know?
Definitely.
There's lots of ways it can end up working out, but I think eventually it will.
Totally. So that, I think that pretty much wraps up the thought that I had going into the episode. You haven't heard Kessler in a minute because he had to step out. So I am finishing up this the show myself.
My apologies.
No.
So long-winded.
No, that wasn't the reason at all. He had a call from Hong Kong. He runs a toy company, so he got a whole thing he's got to do. Sometimes it just happens. So in any case, the last question I had for you is, we just talked about on the intro to the show that I'm actually going to be going to the Team Unified Modern event in San Antonio. I'm really excited. I'm going to be joining two of our listeners. We just announced it, and we're looking for listeners of the show to join the MMCast team. It should be a really collaborative thing. Are you planning on going?
Yeah, I'm doing commentary for that event.
Oh, cool. So you're not going to get to play.
No, I can't play. I'm doing commentary in the event. I'll be in the booth with Marshall and BDM and Luis Scott Vargas covering the event.
Cool. Very cool. Okay.
Really looking forward to it.
Yes. What are your first thoughts? I mean, just shot out of a cannon, what you think the strongest strategy would be with the Unified Modern? Do you think it's going to be metagame dependent at that point?
Well, I mean, it's always metagame dependent, I guess, but I haven't looked at it closely enough to know what a good balance is between the different strategies. Yeah, play, I really
play three good decks that don't overlap. That's the stretch.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if you can like do some reasonable amount of prediction when it comes to figuring out which strategies people are not going to use together.
Right.
And then I think that the better thing is actually tweaking your sideboard for. Like, for instance, there's only going to be 33% at most of certain types of decks and experiences. You know, like there's only going to be at most 33% Lightning Bolts and 33% Ink Moth Nexus and 33% Tarmogoyf.
It's cool. Yeah, it's a cool idea. You actually have to end up preparing pretty for a pretty wide field. You can't just try to spike a tournament with a single idea, which I think makes it really fun. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. We'll have to catch up a little bit when we're there. But
the biggest thing is I wouldn't get too fancy. I would play three good decks that you know, like, are familiar with. And instead of, you know, trying to tech out against other what you perceive to be other decks, Modern is so big. Just play three decks that you know. And then stick to your strengths, and Modern really, really rewards that.
Yeah, definitely. I can't wait. I think it's going to be really fun. That and the Super GP in Vegas are the two big events that I'm looking forward to. So.
Oh, yeah. They're both going to be a blast. Looking forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, it'll be awesome. Patrick, thank you so much for hanging out. I know this episode went a little long, but you offered a lot of really, really valuable insight on the subject. I hope the listeners took away from it as much as we did. So, yeah, man, where can the folks find you and talk about your podcast and all that? Plug anything you want to plug?
sure. Flores would get on me if I didn't. Yeah, no, obviously, Top of a Podcast every Thursday, topofapodcast.com and all that, and Star City Games on Star City Games Premium, you know, every week. And I'm a little bit of a ghost on social media, but I suppose you can follow me, the Peachapin, on Twitter. And I'll occasionally talk, I guess. But I'm going to be doing coverage for some upcoming events, like all over the place. I don't know. You can catch me in the streets.
If you guys couldn't tell, we didn't intro Patrick this time, but he's one of the all-time greatest players. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's won a Pro Tour, tons of events. So, you know, we're not just talking to someone who's rando. You know, that's why he's got the insight to offer. So go check out the podcast. I listen to Top Level every week. I'm a big fan of the show. So keep up the good work on that.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I'm supposed to mention Star City Games also carries the Next Level Magic and Next Level Deck Building. That's where you can definitely find me.
Yeah, Next Level. Right. I've read Next Level Magic, but not Deck Building, and it's great. It's totally informative, and all the you get to go much wider with the theories because you have more time. So anyway, guys, thank you so much for listening, and thank you, Patrick. We'll talk to you again soon.
Awesome. See you, man.
See you, bud.
All right, so that's kind of it for the episode. Once again, thank you to Patrick for coming on. He was great. You can follow him online at
The Chapin.
At The Chapin on Twitter, and you can always check out the content he writes weekly for SEG at starcitygames.com. And remind everyone to follow us on Twitter. We are at The MMCast. You can follow me personally at Kess Wiley.
At Ben Bateman Media.
You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook,
so
YouTube,
so
etc. Yeah. We have a Patreon, and with your help, we can make this show keep on going. We really appreciate it. One other thing for those people donating to the Patreon that are also going to San Antonio for Team Unified Modern, Ben needs a teammate. He is currently
two teammates,
and we are going to pick people that are either current Patreon donators or people that have recently reviewed, starting today, moving forward for the rest of the month of March, probably for the first 2 weeks of March, reviewed the podcast on iTunes, because those are important. That's how we get ranked higher, and we appreciate it in general. Please do either of those things if you can't make it, but if you can make it, you get entered into a chance to play on Ben's team, and you get free modern swag, Master swag. And
all the cards will be provided by the MMCast to be played with, not to be kept, obviously, but to be played with. And the last thing is, as we said, you're entered with a higher number of entries to possibly do this and be the teammate on the MMCast team. If you donate to the Patreon, donators at the higher levels will get more entries, as we do with everything like the swag boxes and everything like that. So if you just feel like being really generous for this month because it gives you a shot to be on the MMCast team, that sounds awesome. I can't wait for this tournament. I think it's going to be really fun to eat some barbecue with you guys and play some Modern. So thanks for listening to the cast, and check out next week's episode for our full Modern Masters 2017 review. Blood Moon's back. Bye, guys.
Boo. Boo, Blood Moon. Boo.
Thank you for your attention. See you later, alligator.